Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Once again, you've stumbled into the web version of STEM Spots, a webcast sponsored by Missouri State University's Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science in conjunction with KSMU, and I'm your host, David Cornelison. As you may already know, we have in the studio with us today two professors from MSU, Dr. Paul Durham and Dr. Bob Pavlovsky. Dr. Durham is the director of the Center for Biomedical and Life Sciences at the Jordan Valley Innovation Center in downtown Springfield, and also professor in the biology department in the College of Natural and Applied Sciences. Dr. Pavlovsky is a member of the Geography, Geology, and Planning Department and also the director of the Ozarks Environmental and Water Resources Institute. And welcome to the program, Bob and Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, if you don't already know, we're talking a little about stream watershed, and the two good doctors here have a program together, a joint collaborative effort that's going to be lasting for a while, where they're going to be looking at water in the Ozarks and looking at chemical and other kinds of analysis done to that water. So we talked a little bit about this already, Bob, and so now I want you to go into a little bit more detail and tell us a little bit about the problems and the challenges that would be associated with your team actually going out and collecting these water samples. What kinds of things do they have to pay attention to? What do they have to be careful of to make sure that there's not contamination issues and other kinds of stuff like that? Give a brief synopsis of what your group's going to be doing.
Yeah, in order to do a study like this, we first have to decide what places we are going to sample. So the whole first process is just trying to find, locate streams that we can get to, springs that we have access to. Once that's done, and that could take a couple months because we have to talk to landowners and make sure that we can drive it in a day. And then after that, we have to make sure that the sites are safe. You don't want people hanging over a cliff trying to pull out a sample, so we have to make sure it's safe. And then the next thing reflects how we sample the environment, where we have to make sure that we have a representative water sample. If we have a place where water is seeping in from another unknown area, we don't want to sample there. We want to sample to make sure that every time we sample, we know our water is coming from a certain spot. And then also we have to measure how much water is flowing out of that spot. And so we have to find a place where Mother Nature has allowed the channel to form a certain way so that we could stick in our velocity probes and figure out how fast the water is flowing, so we can ultimately figure out how much water is flowing on that, out of that spring on that day.
Well, weighing in on that, is that something you would do by going out and actually doing field work and looking for these things? Or do you guys use a lot of GIS kind of data to try to find these sorts of things?
Yeah, our first foray into that would be pulling up maps and data sets from previous studies where we have different sites that we sampled or others have sampled. And today, like you mentioned, with the GIS and remote sensing technologies, we could look on the ground. A lot of people use Google Earth. You can see the ground. You can see the sites. So we can do a lot of site investigation from data that's available, but also from aerial photos that are easily available on the internet.
And will most of the work be done by graduate students or undergraduate students or both?
Most of our work is being done by graduate students with a few undergrads helping out.
Okay. Paul, so these samples are going to be brought back, and you have a certain amount of data associated with the samples. Are you guys doing any kind of blinding on this? Will you know where the samples come from, or will they be labeled in some undetectable way?
Yeah, that's a good question because for us, we actually just had a discussion earlier about this, and Bob and I both agreed that we will be blinded. So when he collects the samples, they'll come up with a code that only they know. So when we get the samples into the lab, we won't have a clue. We'll just know if they're from 15 different sites. And we even talked about that we'll randomize those. So like when he does, like the next month's samples come in, they will actually have a different code so that we can't get into a pattern and kind of be anticipating. So we really want to be blinded to in all the analysis until, we actually sit down at the table and analyze it all.
What kind of other problems might you come up from those kinds of studies you're going to do? So what kind of techniques will you be using? Just give me some standard ideas.
Yeah, so from the chemistry side, we'll be using HPLC, which is just, high pressure liquid chromatography. It's just a fancy way to separate out all the different chemicals within liquids medium. And what that will do is give us a lot of peaks. And the challenge with all this is trying to sort out the noise from, the really valuable information. And so that'll take quite a while. That'll take pretty much the 3 months of the summer to really optimize all the conditions, get the right standards. We'll be focusing in on, about 20 different emerging contaminants. And we're going to be like I said, HPLC will be our main tool for doing that. But we'll also be able to measure things like dissolved oxygen levels. We'll be looking at CO2 levels, because that'll give us an idea of how healthy the water is for biological organisms.
When you're trying to get your characterization, trying to get your standards, are you going to be dosing up water with specific amounts of traces so that you can then compare? Is that what you do for standardization? Or what?
Yeah, so what we'll do is we buy standards that we'll actually spike the samples, and then we can run them to make sure that we can actually identify the peaks. So yeah, we will try to narrow it down, like I said, to about 20, but then we'll also keep our eyes open to see if we do see a peak that we can then go back in and further analyze that. And maybe we might find things in our watershed that, you know, are not, you know, even on the radar, even from, you know, like the EPA or something.
Are you going to split samples? So in other words, you run multiple tests on the same sample that you're given, and then are you going to randomize operators, or are you going to use the same operators on all the tests?
The operators will be pretty standardized, because we have a graduate student and an undergrad that's probably going to be taking the lead on this project, and they will be blinded to it. But I mean, as far as, you know, once you get into this kind of instrument, you know, type of analysis, you really want the same person running the standards and doing the analysis.
Okay. Very good. So now we talked a little bit about the sorts of kinds of things we might find, and we know that we're looking for molecules of interest, and presumably these molecules would be considered as deleterious to the human species in some way, shape, or form. Is that true, Bob? Would you say that that's
we're looking for
negative things?
Yeah, we're going to find a lot of positive things. Whatever's in the water can be. There's a lot of ingredients of the water that are, you know, natural to it, but we're actually looking for more odd and infrequent and even contaminants that may be coming from places where humans have released them before. We're looking for places where some of these things may have been released on the surface of the land and seeped down into the spring caves. Some of them may already be underground, may be leaking from infrastructure such as septic tanks, water supply systems, sewage lines. And then still, you know, others may be coming from very specific sites where a very unique process or chemical has been used, sometimes long in the past, that is still residing in the soil, and we can detect it either from now or even from years ago.
So when you say years ago, I mean, could something be in the soil that may have been put there, let's say, a decade ago or 2 decades ago? What are we talking about here? How long in the past could you conceivably go?
Well, it depends on the chemical that you're looking for, but you can say, you know, there's places around the world and even around Missouri where something like metals that don't degrade over time, we could detect metals in the water 100 years ago that have been released.
And so they basically are in that soil, and they're slowly going into the water stream at a lower level for a while. Is it better that they go slowly over a long period of time, or would it have been better if they all got dumped in at once and flushed from the system?
Well, I think you pay me now or pay me later. And so if we're looking at a situation where contaminant A takes a long time to move through the system, that gives us a long time to worry about downstream effects. But if the site that's being affected, the exposure is a much longer period there, so the site becomes a problem. Places where pollutants move quickly through a system, they move downstream quickly, and we often lose track of where they are. They may become diluted, they may become less effective, but there are differences.
So, Paul, if you were looking at some of these things that might impact humans, for example, or animals, is this the kind of stuff where a low dosage for a long period of time is going to produce an effect? Or is it more likely that people could be getting a sharp dosage at one point in time and then not see the effect for a while? I mean, is it both?
I think it's going to be both. I think there's going to be examples of where you have low doses over, you know, prolonged periods of time, but then there's going to be seasonal things that might occur, or like even with a processing plant or something, where you get a larger influx of something, and then that can infect. And again, I think for us on the biological side, is it's really important, because if those increases occur right at the time of egg development, for example, that could affect the aquatic species. So one of the things that we're really interested in is, as we move forward, is kind of mapping when these surges might happen, and and then monitoring that, and then seeing how that affects the biological organism, especially like the eggs, for frogs and fish, and even looking at bacterial composition.
So does that mean you're pulling in, Paul, somebody from the aquatic side to get involved and do fish sampling, or?
Well, the thing that we were doing is we're actually just using the literature, because there's been a lot of tank studies, if you will, where they've actually put some of these emerging contaminants in the water systems and then kind of been able to establish biological norms of what's, you know, safe and what's not safe. For example, like with some of the estrogen mimickers, we know that once you reach a certain level, you're basically going to start feminizing that species. So we're going to be looking at it, you know, from a quantitative side. And if we start seeing levels that are approaching that threshold, then that's when we're going to, you know, be very interested in it.
And at that time, you might think about bringing a wildlife biologist in and do some sampling, or conceivably down the road.
And at least collaborating with them to get their opinion on it. And maybe, yeah, even collaborating with, even trying to replicate it in the aquatic center here or something.
Now, are they worried about the impact on native Missouri species specifically when people think about this sort of thing? Or when, let's say that a public planner was involved in this at some level, would they be more interested in direct impact on humans, or would they be interested in the wildlife impact that would then subsequently conceivably affect humans?
Yeah, and I think it depends on what kind of contaminant we're talking about. You know, we do have some species that are very unique to the Ozark region, like the hellbender, for example. So there are, you know, basically aquatic organisms here that really aren't found anywhere else. So I think we're going to have to be sensitive to the idea that there might be certain contaminants in the water that could be affecting their life cycle.
Bob. So now you get this work done. You work on it for on the order of a year. You find something out. Let's say there are real implications. Do you go ahead and publish it right off the bat? Do you go ahead and talk to some officials that are associated with the county? I know you have longstanding contracts with city and other agencies. And so would you go ahead and talk to those people probably first and let them see what kind of results you were looking at? How would you go about disseminating the information, do you suppose?
Yeah, I'm typically what we would do is after we've replicated a certain pattern of the data of the water quality, we would share that information with the public agencies, let them know what we find. And then at the same time, we're sort of working on putting it into an article, getting it out for a review so that we get comments from other scientists on it. Because in the end, detecting something, as long as we do the right protocol, would be considered a positive result in terms of it has factual value. So just knowing that, you know, we hit it would be something that people would like to know.
Have you guys already thought about collaborating with somebody about mitigation? So there are people who specifically worry about this sort of things and about how they can either modify human behavior or fix things after the fact. Have you talked to anybody about either one of those things, trying to get them involved, or are you going to wait?
I think we're waiting now, because we have partners that work on that side of things, or environmental education people that are managers that could move this up the chain to maybe looking for responses. But right now, we're a group that's out looking for the presence of these substances in the water. That's basically what we're doing now.
Sure. How equipment intensive is this, Paul? I mean, do you have everything you need over at JVIC right now, or are there things that you need that you don't have right now?
We have all the equipment that we need as far as, you know, to do the analysis for both the chemical analysis and the biological. And getting back to your earlier point about, I think one of the things that has been really helpful is like the hospitals and the pharmacies are getting the word out that people shouldn't really be flushing things down the toilet. So, you know, if you have drugs that have expired or you're no longer using, don't just flush them down the toilet. Bring them to a pharmacy, bring them to the hospital, and they'll dispose of them in an appropriate manner so it doesn't contaminate our water systems.
Right. You know, to tie in the educational output of this, will there be people that are likely to get a master's thesis out of this or some sort of credit towards their research productivity, conceivably?
Right now, I think we're using it more as a team learning experience. Since we're all split up into, you know, different groups, and it's sort of experimental. I don't have somebody on it as a master's thesis, and I don't think Paul does, and I don't think the microbiologists do that either. So it's sort of an experimental kind of thing, and I think if we hit, we'll be all right. We'll maybe be able to get a student on it later.
Yeah, one of the things that we have within the CNAS department is that MANS degree. So it's actually a mixed degree. So we potentially could get a student out of there that would be able to bridge the two, you know, the the water quality analysis that Bob's doing with, you know, basically the chemical analysis. So we could get a student that might actually be able to work through that kind of a mechanism to get their master's degree.
I think what you're talking about is the Master of Natural and Applied Sciences. That's a cooperative degree where you pick two areas to emphasize and mix those up and get an interdisciplinary master's degree.
Right.
And that is something that CNES offers. That's a good degree.
Well,
I really do appreciate you coming in to talk about this project. Obviously, the development of water resources and the monitoring of those kinds of things are important to people everywhere, and especially in the Ozarks, I think, with our emphasis on the natural environment. So once again, you've been listening to STEM Spots with Paul Durham and Bob Flavowski, both from the College of Natural Applied Sciences at Missouri State University. And I'm your host, David Cornelson, from the Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Material Science. And we hope you tune in again soon. Thank you.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.